This is a podcast from ABC Overnights. Here's Trevor Chappell.
It's called The Artley Poor Monkey. Basically tells the story of a monkey that falls off a ship or a galleon outside and swims ashore in Hartlepool. And the belief is that the Hartlepool monkey was a spy. Is it a true story, though? Emma Southern joins us, Dr. Emma Southern, historian and co-host of the History is Sexy podcast. Hello, Emma.
Hello.
Is the story of the Hartlepool monkey a true story?
I'm in my role as crusher of dreams today, which is no, it's not.
Oh, I thought
but
it was.
They really like it. The people of Hartlepool, which is in northeastern England, have really lent into the idea, but it sadly is not a true story.
Because for years I've listened to that song with the belief that it was based on something that actually happened.
Well, it seems to be based on another song, actually, making fun of Hartlepool from the Victorian period. And there was a travelling singer called Ned Corvin who would travel around England, and he would write a different song for every town that he went to, making fun of them for something ludicrous.
Yeah.
And so he came up with this song, and he wrote this song about them hanging a monkey because they don't know the difference, because they're so silly, they don't know the difference between a monkey and a Frenchman. And it was so good, and everybody in the area so enjoyed it. And it particularly came at a time when there was a new industrial kind of estate that had been built onto Hartlepool, who likes to make fun of the old villagers. So the newcomers, the industrialized newcomers, would sing the song, and then gradually it has become part of like Hartlepool mythology.
So they embraced it instead of being offended.
Oh, they've really embraced it. Like their football team, the mascot for their football team is a hanged monkey called Hangus. Their rugby team is called the Monkey Hangers. They voted that football mascot mayor 3 times. Like, they will happily sing that song. They've got a statue.
They've got a statue.
They think it's hilarious.
A very macabre story.
It is a very macabre story, and it really could have gone either way in terms of them really leaning into it or really taking offence. But no, they love it. They think it's very, very funny.
Let's take a look at some others of whether or not they happened or didn't happen, or where it merges and whether there's a basis for the stories to be considered true. Let's start with King Arthur.
Okay. So King Arthur is... not real. This is me going to be saying not real a lot. But he is a figure from kind of English and Welsh folklore who comes from the Saxon invasions of England and Wales. And he kind of developed in folklore and kind of folk tales that this heroic king will protect them from the Saxons. But is very much told as a kind of fairy tale. And then he comes through, the guy called Geoffrey of Monmouth wrote what would now be seen as a fantasy novel, basically, about the history of England, called The History of Kings of Britain, which includes King Arthur and kind of creates the story of King Arthur and the Guinevere and all of his knights. And
there's no round table.
Avalon. That comes much later, actually. It comes from French romances. He's really big during the Norman period. So when you have that English-French crossover, French language, and then later into England, romance songs and poems tell all these stories about the knights, and then they can pin, like, it becomes a central point from which lots of stories can come off of. So you can say that one knight went off and did this, and it links them all together in a kind of Marvel universe.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So then you tell a story, but if you link it to King Arthur and his round table, then you've got an automatic distribution.
So But I heard stories about, because you talked about the Welsh. I heard that the Cornish like to hold on to a little bit of King Arthur as well. And is it one of those stories that people like to keep alive and keep the legend alive or alive so that it actually adds to their region as well?
Oh, very much. So it gives you, like, much like the Hartlepool monkey and things like that, it gives people a reason to go to a place and talk about it. And you know, we still have ravens in the Tower of London because the myth is that if the ravens ever leave the Tower of London, then that means that King Arthur's going to come back and save us.
So people did hold on to the story as true?
Pretty much. It disappears for a long time during the kind of Enlightenment period and the Tudor period. Like, they're not really into it. But it gets revived in the 19th century, and there's this, like, romantic revival of the medieval past and English past. And then people start to hold on to it as history and start to tell it as history rather than telling it as fiction. So it's kind of through 19th century romantic that it becomes linked to history through Tennyson and people like that. Probably not, unless there was just one Welsh guy who was really good at fighting. I'll tell you one story from Arthurian legend which probably or might be true, is the story of Tom Thumb.
We're talking today with Emma Southern, Dr. Emma Southern, about the myths, the legends, and when they get confused with reality, or history, we'll call it. Emma, a couple of texts. So a couple of people are wanting to say that, please say that Camelot was real, because one person visited Camelot and Glastonbury and Titangel. And she'd like to think that it's true. Another one saying Henry VIII, who was Welsh, was definitely into the Camelot legend, and he called his first son Arthur.
Well, there you go. He was very big into his Welsh history.
Still doesn't make it true. Jeez, you're mean.
Unfortunately.
So what's the story of Tom Thumb?
So Tom Thumb is a part of Arthurian legend as well. He's one of the many who is said to be the dwarf of King Arthur, and gets told a lot in the medieval period. And he was thought to be a kind of fairy tale or a bit ridiculous, because in the legends he is the size of your thumb, which is obviously tiny. But in a church in Lincolnshire, an inscription has been found from 1620, which would be a bit late, but not too bad, which reads, Tom Thumb died 1620, aged 101 years old, and the tomb is only about a foot and a half long, less than a foot and a half. So it is a tiny little person called Tom Thumb. Now, it might be the other way around, that they called him Tom Thumb because of the legend, but it's nice to think of it the other way.
So nothing to do then with Thumbelina?
No, Thumbelina is a fairy tale. That's that is Hans Christian Andersen. Unless there is a tomb of a Thumbelina somewhere. But she grew.
Oh, there is a song.
So
there's a song. Danny Kaye sang it.
That's true. But as we've learned, things and songs can't be trusted.
from the Hartlepool monkey.
Yeah, exactly.
Anthony, hello.
Yeah, good evening. How are you?
Good, thanks, Anthony.
I was just wondering. Emma is obviously English.
And she's really smart. Anyway, go on.
of course she's really smart. I was just wondering, because I know, like, King Arthur, or Uther, as we like to say. I think there's a reference to that in Winston Churchill's biographies of his histories.
What, that Churchill believed in him?
Apparently so. And as far as I know, there is also this myth, inverted commas, that he was around in Roman times or before Roman times, Celtic times.
Whoa, Emma?
There is the... he kind of gets linked back to Roman and pre-Roman times, but because it all goes back to... oral history, basically. He's certainly is placed by people like Geoffrey of Monmouth in like the end of the Roman period, so the period after the Romans have pulled out, and what is considered to be the kind of dark age of English history. That is largely when he is placed. But you would have to believe Geoffrey of Monmouth, and Geoffrey of Monmouth is not very trustworthy.
I was just going to say, he would have been 15th or 14th century, wouldn't he? I assume.
Yes.
Okay, so we're going pre-written history with no references, right?
Yeah, so he's like King Arthur is completely a pre-written, like oral folklore figure who is floating around in various guises in oral histories in kind of that part of Western England and Wales for a very long time before anybody gets around to writing it down.
It's a cracker of a story. Anthony, thank you. I've got to move on.
Yep, no worries.
Thank you. It's a cracker of a story, though, if it's lasted for that long and through so many different incarnations, Emma.
It is. It's amazing how, like, early and how stable a lot of the kind of figures are in it as well. Like, Guinevere is there from the beginning and Camelot and the sword. And it gets made religious later on with the link to the Holy Grail and things. But, like, the core story, and then Lancelot's quite an early addition by the French. They pop him in. But a lot of it is there really, really early on, and it's kind of stuck in its very similar form for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years.
Can I come back to the Fisher King and the Holy Grail in just a little bit?
Yeah.
Jimmy, hello.
G'day.
Yes, Jimmy.
Hello. Pleasure to talk to you again. My question was about Beowulf.
Yeah, Beowulf.
What's the story, Emma?
So the story of Beowulf is a 10th century story set a bit before that in the kind of Netherlandsy region, the north, northern Europe. And the story is that there is a monster who is attacking kings in the area, and Beowulf, a hero, comes to protect everybody and bring glory upon his family, and he fights the monster Grendel and kills him, and then swims under the water for like a full day in order to be able to kill Grendel's mother and thus end the plague of this monster who is ripping people apart.
Has to be true.
So it's kind of a heroic epic.
Has to be true.
I mean, it's very fantastical. It literally does have a monster in it, and Beowulf does swim underwater for a whole day, yeah. And he is a... the idea of kind of kings fighting each other's battles for them in order to protect a weak king or to... He's made an heir to a throne because he's so good at fighting, that kind of thing, is like... The generalities are definitely based in a reality, and it's generally believed that the world that it describes is very, very realistic, but there are very fantastical elements. So maybe he killed a boar or something.
Yeah, and he might have swum for like a couple of hours.
Yeah, but he does swim underwater for 24 hours, which is, I think, pushing it a bit.
That's pushing it a lot, really. lots of people, I'll come to your calls in just a second, but there are heaps of people wanting to know about Robin Hood.
Robin Hood's a great one, that's why. He's a complicated one as well, because he is another figure from English oral folklore, this time from the kind of Midlands. So he's completely based in Nottingham. He's never based anywhere else in any of the stories. And he's always based in Sherwood Forest. And the first mentions of him are people complaining in the 14th century, so in the 1300s, complaining that people are kind of turning up to parties dressed as this Robin Hood and causing trouble. And dressing up as Robin Hood and mischief making was obviously a thing that people did in the 13th century for fun. And then he is first written about in the kind of mid-15th century. People start writing ballads about him, and you get these songs about Robin Hood, who is an outlaw, who lives in the forest. And this is much less stable. It kind of changes a lot in different stories, but it builds up through all of these stories, this idea of this outlaw, and then gradually he gains the Merry Men, or one or two of the Merry Men, and then Maid Marian is attached, and then all of the rest of it kind of appear in different versions of the story. The idea of him robbing people and giving to the poor starts in the early 15th century, when he is saying he robs from somebody and then he'll give it to the next person that he sees on the road, regardless of who they are. And then in 1592, that becomes him only robbing from the rich in order to help the poor. And then he becomes this hero of the poor. But he actually starts as a yeoman, which is a kind of artisan class, like a specialist class. So he's never a peasant. But the idea of the outlaw who lives outside of normal society and fights with the sheriff of Nottingham, who's always the baddie, is really an old one. And that's never died in English story. Whether it's true is really, people have argued about a lot, and is complicated by the fact that Robin Hood was a really common name.
Oh, was it?
So all of the records, there's loads of Robin Hoods from any period that it could be, because Robin is a really common first name, and Hood potentially just means person who makes hoods. So there's tons of them. But people have come up with about 8 that they think it might be. And the other suggestion is that Robin Hood was just a name given to anyone who was an outlaw, basically. But there are some that are quite, quite convincing, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Like, there are some where you have a Robin Hood with a Little John, who lives in a wood. And so it's kind of plausible that it could be this Little John. And there's people who fight over this quite a lot.
Good. So does that mean
there might have been?
So does that mean that? So there would have been a Sheriff of Nottingham.
There was definitely a Sheriff of Nottingham, and obviously the setting in the setting in the Disney film kind of confuses things a little bit, because it has John ruling as a king while Richard I is away, which never happened. But that kind of setting of end of Henry II's reign, Richard I being away, being a Lionheart and being kidnapped in France, all of that is a historical period, and it's like it's always based in that historical period.
Lovely.
And there's a lot of Robin Hoods, and at least 8 people that people think it might have been.
See, it's clever wrapping it around the idea of the Lionheart, Richard the Lionheart, and all of that sort of stuff, because it then starts to give it some historic text as well.
It does. And it then ties it to a specific time, so which makes it easier for people who are looking for other people.
So we can say that. We can't say it didn't exist, but we can put a half a tick and say it maybe happened.
Yeah, and there were definitely, we can tell you that for a fact that there were people with names that were similar to Robin Hood, or were Robin Hood, or were Robert Hood, who were outlaws who in the north and Midlands of England, and who were potentially bandits as well. So
that's good enough for me. Someone said, don't diss Robin Hood. So we're not dissing Robin Hood.
We'd never diss Robin Hood.
Felon, yes.
Although in the very earliest ones, he's horrible. So.
Oh, okay. So we did diss him.
He doesn't do any... there's no giving to the poor and no goodness in the very earliest kind of stories that he's in. He's just a murderer.
Felon, very quickly.
Yeah, mate, real quick one. I had a thing come up from social media, which is a bad place to get history from, but I'm a bit of an Elizabethan tragic, and it would appear, according to this, that our current royal family, with Queen Elizabeth at the head, shares a direct descendant with the following people: Princess Diana, Sarah Ferguson,
right? You go, keep going.
And the originator is claimed to have been Mary Boleyn. And it shows the direct line of very important marriages to history. I was just wondering if our history lady can tell me, is this...
Do you mean, sorry, Fallon, do you mean Anne Boleyn?
No, her sister Mary.
Oh, there we go.
Oh.
Anything to that?
I don't know off the top of my head. Oh, but she definitely does go up to Anne Boleyn, because you can trace her right the way back to Alfred, I think, or at least to William.
Okay.
I don't know who her children were, but I would say, given the freakish amount of intermarriage, probably.
Thank you, Fallon. Hello, Bill.
Oh, yes, good morning, Trev and Emma. St. Brendan, Emma, the Brendan Voyage. You ever heard the Brendan Voyage where they reckon he went to America 800 years before Columbus, and Columbus used his manuscripts, and they recreated the voyage and did it. And if you go on YouTube, you can see it. That fellow who recreated, Tim Severin, he only died about a year or two back.
Do you know that story?
Oh, I've never heard that story before.
It's a really, if you go on YouTube, you can see the whole documentary when they recreated the voyage and proved it could be done. And he came from County Kerry, yeah. And there's all, Christy Moore's got a song about him, about St. Brendan, yeah.
Look, thank you. Maybe can that be a little homework, Emma?
That can be some homework.
We'll have a look at St. Brendan. Now, I wanted to go back and take a look at the Holy Grail, because we were talking about the Fisher King, the film, just a little while. And I've got a couple of texts here, one saying, the joint tales of the Fisher King and the Handless Maiden are very often worth examining, says Ben.
They are, and they are Arthurian as well, from the same kind of culture of lovely, thrilling, heroic, and then later religious kind of romantic adventures of glory and heroism. So the Fisher King comes from French again, I'm afraid. French stories, a story of Saint Percival or Knight Percival, who goes looking for the Holy Grail, which becomes like a really strong story. Everyone's always looking for the Holy Grail. And the Fisher King is supposed to be the last of the line of people of the family who are caring for the Grail, but he has been wounded or is incapable of standing, and he fishes in a boat. And the aim is that they have to heal the Fisher King in order to get to the Grail. And he is thought to be deriving from Celtic mythology, and to be linked less to these ideas of... All right, so I'm going to do the difference between legend and myth.
Yes, please.
So the legend, legend is something which is kind of tied to tangible history, basically, and is often linked to a specific point in the past. So Robin Hood is linked to... the specific point when the king is not in England and everything is mildly chaotic, or King Arthur is linked to a specific point when there's no kind of unity in England. And so a legend is something which is connected to reality in some way, and usually is trying to bring order to the world, or sometimes they have supernatural elements, but they usually don't. Whereas a myth is something which is bigger and usually is connected to something in nature or in religion, and they almost always have a god or something supernatural or extra human that makes it a myth rather than a legend.
Thank you. Janet wants to go back to King Arthur for a sec. Hello, Janet.
Hello. How are you? How are you, Emma? Okay.
I'm well,
just
thank
going.
You.
Um, There is mention of Arthur, which predates the Geoffrey of Monmouth, and that's in the Welsh poem A Gododdin. And it mentions in the Gododdin that it talks about the leaders who fought at the Battle of Catterick. And it says of one leader, On Doisodim Arthur, he was not Arthur. But that can be translated as On Doisodim Arthur, which means he was not the leader of the charge, which suggests that Arthur is not a person, but a position in a military arrangement.
Oh, there we go.
There you go. That's very interesting.
So, Isir Pendragon, who was Arthur's father, Arthur means the leader of the charge. Pen is head, and Dragon is the overall chieftain.
And I do love it when you speak Welsh.
Yeah, that was great. I love it.
And to link in with some of the other Arthurian knights, a Galawad is a caller in Welsh. It's a Galahad.
Yep.
Yeah.
A Gawain is the scabbard in Welsh. So that would be the keeper of the weapons. Sir Gawain. And Gareth, it would be pebbles. So that would be a group of people who would throw pebbles.
Janet, thank you. The last time we spoke to Janet, she explained to us the story of Haraith. Is that how you say it, Janet?
Haraith.
And I did find a Welsh historian to talk to about that on another day. So I'm still chasing that up, Janet.
Nice.
Thank you. Don't you love the Welsh language?
Welsh history is not taught anywhere near enough, and especially not all those kind of Welsh epics and things. Like Irish history, we don't learn enough about it in England.
A couple of quick ones, Emma. Firstly, St. George and the Dragon.
So that is definitely a legend. Off the top of my head, I don't know where it comes from, but there's dragons in it. Allegedly, he's Turkish. I know that because people bring it up all the time.
Okay, so not well. Maybe he fought something and not a dragon.
Maybe.
No is the answer. William Tell, who shot the apple off his son's head.
Yes, so he's big in Swiss mythology, stories. As far as we know, he was a real person.
So that's true. We don't know whether or not shot an apple off his son's head, though.
No, but he comes from Swiss, folklore, basically. He's a folklore of Swiss. He's supposed to be assassinated a Habsburg. Savior of the people, basically. He also comes from the 15th century. And then he's a symbol of, a lot of these ones are symbols of peasant or lower class revolt against a tyrannical person. And he's one of those. So he has all of these legends about how he's because he assassinated Habsburg, or supposedly, how he was the greatest marksman that ever existed. And that he could shoot an apple from very far away.
See, I always put him and Robin Hood in the same bucket, which is probably incredibly wrong, but anyhow. So who's more likely to be real, William Tell or Robin Hood?
Depends. I reckon you can probably say that there was a bunch of people who could be a Robin Hood. I think that there's a lot of argument. It's less popular to say that William Tell was not real. Whether he was an individual is a different question, but I'm going to say that he's more likely to have been a real one person.
All right. Steve joins us. Good morning, Steve.
Hello.
Steve.
G'day. Look, have you ever heard of a Scottish cannibal? This is a disturbing story, by the name of Sawney Bean, SawneyBeane.
How far back, Steve?
We're probably talking about the 14 or 1500s.
About the 16th century, Emma?
I do know.
Do you?
So this is
you love the gruesome ones.
I do love the gruesome ones. I wrote a whole book about the gruesome ones. but yeah, he is supposed to have like rampaged through Scotland with his clan and murdered and cannibalized like 1,000 people during the reign of James the Sixth, who is James the First of England. And he, yeah, there's all these kind of gruesome stories told about how he is this kind of monstrous Scottish person. The most of the stories about him come from like the 19th century in the tabloid news of the like Victorian, like early Victorian period. And there are other, there's no contemporary evidence for him. It all comes from much later on. And there is a story that it is linked to, which is a mythical story. Caliber called Christy Cleek, and most people I think now would say they probably didn't really happen. He definitely didn't kill 1,000 people and eat them.
Let's have a quick chat with Tony. Hello, Tony.
How are you?
Yes, Tony.
If you look at the Nag Hammadi library in the Gospels of Mary and Thomas and others, it indicates that Mary Magdalene was actually the wife of Jesus. And the Grail is actually the bloodline of their offspring.
Yes, the Holy Grail, Holy Blood, theory. So that was made very popular by the Da Vinci Code, but was originally, as far as I'm aware, comes from the hypothesis put from Holy Blood and Holy Grail, which is. Michael Badgent and a couple of other people who developed this thesis. But yeah, it was very big for a while there, and has a whole kind of mythology going right the way back. But it has some stuff in it which is definitely a bit dodgy, so which undermines it for me, because it pulls on very anti-Semitic documents. But yeah, that was. The Holy Blood, Holy Grail thing was certainly very popular.
Thank you, Tony. Question here. Emma, Wild West quick draws never happened. So did they used to have quick draws with holsters where they would pace out and then fastest person to their gun would win?
Certainly not anywhere near as much as you would think. The number that you could actually count is like, 3 or 4 that you know of. And there were like, there's one very, very famous one, with Wild Bill Hickok, like the one that everybody knows about, but actually you can't really, one, shooting people at any point is not that great. And it doesn't look good. And two, it actually is like really difficult to get your like quick draw holsters and things like that were not that common. Or that easy to kind of fast draw your handgun out of that era's holster. So definitely wasn't something that happened every 15 minutes. And actually, I believe that the popularity of portraying those in films and kind of stories from the Old West, which is full of all of those kind of legendary figures, kind of led to the development of an actual quick draw holster. but dueling, I think, was more along the lines of less kind of quick draw, but more along the lines of old fashioned, like the first to fire is the first to and hit, like more old fashioned English dueling than it was quick draw dueling.
Let's take a look at, we'll tick off a couple very quickly. Did Marie Antoinette actually say, let them eat cake?
No.
What did she say?
That one comes from a story. Actually, I quite like this one because it comes from a Rousseau book about his memoirs written when Marie Antoinette was 8. So she definitely couldn't have been saying anything about anyone. And he is looking for some bread to have with his wine and he can't find any. So he says, I remembered that a great princess once said, let them hate cake. So he had some cake instead. And that's where it comes from.
Okay, let's cross that one off. Caligula made his horse a senator.
No, this one's my bugbear. No, it comes from one sentence in Suetonius where he says that had he lived longer, it said he was going to make his horse a senator, but he never actually did.
People have dined out on that for years.
I know. He did let his horse have a an allegedly gold-plated stable, though. So.
Oh, that's fair.
Yeah.
That's all right.
He doesn't like the horse. So.
Napoleon was short.
Yes, for us, but not for his time. He was 5'6" but in French, there's a difference between the French inch at the time and the English inch, and he's 5'2" in English inches, which was what was reported. But he was 5'6", but he surrounded himself with very tall people, which is why it was funny to call him very short.
The two more. Firstly, did the Vikings wear horned hats?
They didn't, no.
That's sad.
It is. That imagery very specifically comes from one performance of Wagner's Ring Cycle from the 19th century, where a guy called Karl-Emil Doppler designed this kind of very iconic Viking imagery. And that really captured the imagination of the Germans and then everybody else. We do have archaeologically horned helmets, but they're from much, much earlier than the Vikings, and they seem to be kind of very delicate ritual pieces. There's some really cool ones called the Versko or Verska helmets, but they're from like 1000 BC, which is 2000 years before the Vikings.
Did they wear metal hats at all?
They wore helmets, but like more like ones that would be good in war, kind of rounded, pointy ones with a nose shield. Whereas wearing a helmet with big horns on it is not very good in a war situation because it's a very easy thing for people to just grab hold of.
Yeah, but you could just like run at them and headbutt them.
You could, but the Vikings never thought of it, unfortunately. Right. Well, they specifically didn't, yeah.
Brett wants to know... the story of Vlad the Impaler of Romania, which led to the legend of Dracula of Transylvania.
That one is true, as far as I'm aware.
We spoke about Vlad the Impaler when we were talking about the world's nastiest people.
We did. He was certainly a kind of very monstrous ruler who had a real reputation for being a very cruel invader of places who did terrible things to the people that he captured, right the way from his from the kind of contemporary period he was, and then he becomes a kind of monster as it goes through. Like, obviously they get worse and worse and worse, but through as stories go. But yeah, he was in his lifetime considered to be truly horrible.
Very quickly, Pied Piper.
I don't know the Pied Piper. Homework. I'm going to say probably not, but never mind.
The reason... it's probably not. Get that out.
It might mean maybe. You never, it's always surprising which ones turn out to be true.
Now, before we go, I wanted to... Because the reason that we're talking about this was not only the Hartlepool Monkey, but when I was listening to one of your podcasts, you were talking about, which is History is Sexy, which are great podcasts if you get the opportunity to listen. You were talking about how you actually shattered the myth of which I had never heard of something called the Chinese tickle torture.
Yes. So we did a whole podcast on the Chinese tickle torture because somebody asked if it was possible to tickle someone to death, basically. And I ended up reading a lot of Chinese torture manuals, which was fun. And we discovered that they were definitely not into tickling people to death, but they did do all kinds of, because largely that's a terrible way to torture somebody. And they had lots and lots and lots of actual proper tortures, which they wrote down in gruesome detail. But we couldn't find it anywhere. And then somebody sent us a message on Facebook saying that they think that they are personally responsible for coming up with the story, so that they wrote about it on the internet in the early days of the internet.
Can we go back though? So were there people that actually believed that there was such a thing as the Chinese tickle torture?
Yes. And if you Google it, you'll find all kinds of like just kind of casual references to it. And people will say like the idea is that you would tie someone up and then tickle them and let them not die. There's like a Wikipedia page for it. And yeah, you'll just find loads of stuff that, that comes up with it. But it is just not a thing.
So this person said, "I'll write something funny on the internet," and then it just continued.
Basically, yeah. And they think that they, it was an American guy, who kind of, yeah, just made something up in the way that things kind of go round and round on the internet. And it just really took off. And largely because of like Orientalism, it, like is a thing, it sounds weird and amusing, like that you can say, oh, the Chinese did this. And it kind of had, China has this reputation in the West of like being a place where odd things happen. And I think I said at the time, like you say Chinese tickle torture or Chinese water torture, but no one ever says like American waterboarding. It's like a specifically, you know, it's an Orientalist way of talking about it in the first place. But yeah, it is like a weird story that kind of links to the way that people who don't think, who don't like, I'm trying to think about it very hard, will go, oh yeah, that sounds like something that would happen in medieval China, but it didn't.
And you, through your wonderful podcast, discovered the reality.
Yeah, exactly.
Emma, it's always good talking to you. Thank you.
I always learn a lot when I come on here, so it's great.
Catch you later. Dr. Emma Southern, historian, author, and co-presenter of History is Sexy, which is a podcast. This is Overnights.